Nehemiah, actually we're at the back of chapter 9, verse 38, and then we will, it's the chapter divisions are a little off in Nehemiah. Chapter 10 is the logical conclusion of what would happen if the people of God really got serious and read His Word and truly repented of their sin. So if I read and understand what I'm doing wrong and I repent of my sin, the logical conclusion is I will make a commitment. And so beginning in chapter 9 of Nehemiah, verse 38, because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing. Now, please remember the Hebrew custom of making a covenant. Previously, they made a covenant by, literally, in the flesh. The Hebrew word to make a covenant literally means you to cut. You cut a covenant. And so the concept of the circumcision of the foreskin and the male is the cutting of a covenant. So you see that now culturally they've changed, and this has happened to us. Our church is having some issues getting the bank that we borrowed a bunch of money from that we're paying off to accommodate us in having some pictures made and getting some people in the church to actually pay it off so that we can kind of celebrate that, because the bank is no longer owned locally. It's now owned by some conglomerate somewhere, and so their customs and their manners of doing things are different than the old Southern way of doing things. But even that has changed, if you think about it. I remember when I was a young boy going with my granddad to the bank to borrow money. And he went in, and the man's name, who was the president of the bank, his last name was Money. So we went to see Mr. Money about borrowing some money. And granddaddy told me to sit down and to be seen and not heard, which I heard a lot as a little child growing up. And so I took my seat in the little chair there, and he talked to Mr. Money, and he told Mr. Money how much money he needed. I don't remember what that was, but Mr. Money instructed a teller to go get so much cash out of the vault, I guess, or wherever, I don't know. And she comes and hands Mr. Money the money, and I remember him counting the money out on the desk. And granddaddy picking it up and shaking Mr. Money's hand, putting it in his pocket and telling me, let's go. That was done routinely as the way business was done particularly among certain Southern men during that time. We don't do that anymore. You don't seal a deal with a handshake. You have to have a contract, and a contract written by a very clever lawyer so as not to have gotten yourself messed up because you did not read the proverbial fine print, okay? Well, we see in this text that they're changing how they do the covenant. They're now writing it. They're writing it down. And they're going to seal it, and they're going to put their names on it. So this is as close in the Bible as what you and I talk about today of writing something or signing your name to it. At our church, the way you now join our church is you sign the member covenant, because that's how we make commitments in our society now. We put our name on the bottom line. And so that's what we see here in Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 38. Because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing on the sealed document are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. So in other words, our rulers, the guys who have the authority to commit us to something, are doing this, okay? Now, verse 10 or chapter 10, verse 1, gives us this whole list of names. And I'm not going to read all those because I don't see any benefit in it. I want you to go to verse 28. Well, you know, later I will if you want me to. But it'll take some time out of the actual what we want to see. So here's the outline of this chapter. The verse 38 is the introduction, and then you have the names of those who sign it. The chief leaders and priests are first, the first eight verses. Then the Levites who sign are the next five verses. And then the remaining half of those verses are for the leaders of the people who sign. But then where we want to start is number five on this outline, chapter 10, verse 28. The promise, what they're actually saying as they sign, what they're agreeing to, the deal they're making, the covenant they're making, or the commitment they're making to God. The rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and all who were separated themselves from the peoples of the lands of the law of God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, all who have knowledge and understanding, join with their brothers, their nobles, and enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and to do all the commandments of the Lord our God and His rules and His statutes. Now, what's this idea of entering into a curse? What's that? Where's that come from? Okay, go back to Deuteronomy. I think it's chapter 30-something. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's in there. They're walking between two mountains. And Moses names one mountain cursing and one mountain blessing. And if you do all that is written in the law, you will be blessed. And if you don't do all that is written in the law, you will be cursed. And so that imagery is in their head. To disobey is to be cursed. And think about it. They all know that because they're still under the bondage of this king, even though he's a benevolent king who's allowed them to come back. They're still not a free people. And they've been cursed. They know that the north has been condemned and it no longer exists, and their country no longer exists as it once did. So they understand that if you don't do God's law, if you don't honor the commitments you make, you don't obey, you're cursed. And this is something I think we need to apply to ourselves. While we might not use the word cursed, we might speak in not being blessed, blessed and not blessed. Those of us who accept Christ as Savior and make commitments and keep them receive blessing. Those of us who receive Christ and make commitments and don't keep them, we don't receive those blessings. And I don't want to make too much of it, but I do think that if you honor God with the first fruits, you know, you tithe, and this is what some of this we'll get into, I think your tires last longer. Your car, you know, there are things. God has that ability to preserve things for us. Remember the children of Israel in the 40 years we read last week? Even their feet didn't swell. Their clothes didn't wear out. So God has the ability to cause the things which we possess to last longer if we are being blessed. And so we need to put ourselves in a position whereby we may be blessed. So that's where that comes from, this idea of cursing. Now, in verse 30, we will not give our daughters to the people of the land or take their daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring in goods or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. And we will forego the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Now, let's look at some of this. They're going to avoid being unequally yoked in marriage is how we would say it, verse 30. Now, I don't know what you ladies can say about this, but I can tell you that, and I tell young ladies this all the time, if they would just listen to one thing I tell them, just this one thing. Quit marrying guys or quit dating guys who aren't Christians. They aren't there. They would just do that. Because I don't know how many heartbroken young ladies come to me routinely wishing they had listened. There's a young lady wanting me to go to jail to visit her boyfriend to see if he is ready to receive Christ. And I said, I'll be glad to visit him, but you have no business with this being your boyfriend if you're a Christian. You know, you're just stupid for doing that. Oh, but I love him. Well, la-di-da, you know. I really wish I could get people to see this because being unequally yoked both ways, whether it's a male or female, this is the number one problem. And it's the number one Satan has to ruin Christian families. And we're just so stupid. We keep doing the same thing over and over and over. Spoke to a guy yesterday. And he said that he was getting a divorce. I'd been talking to him, trying to get he and his wife to come to church. And they're getting a divorce now. And he told me three times in the conversation, but it's the best thing in the long run. It's the best thing in the long run. Well, unfortunately, there are, but not by each. Each brought a child to the marriage, so that wasn't the first marriage for either of them. But it's not best in the long run, but that's the kind of lie we tell ourselves because we don't have to face whatever the issues are. And so this is one of those issues that we really need to see here. And as I've read Nehemiah, I just see so much that applies to today's church. We are so guilty and so in need to hear this. But that idea of being unequally yoked. So that's verse 30. They're not going to give their children to be married. Now, in our society, we've gotten to the place where we say, well, we can't withhold the blessing. Our children, they'll get married anyway. Well, that may be. I don't know. But I've always talked to my children about who they're dating. And they'll tell me, you know, they've have a date, my first question is, are they a Christian? Are they a Christian? And my oldest son is married now, and he's married to a good Christian young lady. My youngest son is not married. He's not even dating anyone. He says that he has need to get through school, and he doesn't need that distraction. And so I'm amazed by that wisdom and tickled to death by it because it does not come from me. But I'm excited by that. But we need to really be praying for our young people. And you as, you know, whether it's grandchildren, children, great-grandchildren, whatever influence you have, this is a place. You know, if you have so much relational capital to spend, this is a good place to spend it. You know, because you can save them a lot of heartache, if possible. Now, this next one really gets uncomfortable for us. We're not going to buy anything on the Sabbath. Did you see or hear that? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I tell you what. I have offered every Sunday on the way home when my kids were smaller, I would say, where are we going to eat, Daddy? I said, well, I'll take you Chick-fil-A. Well, it's closed today. Well, I guess we'll have to go to Pam's place then. That's my wife's name, Pam. So, we really have some issues here. I grew up having to work on Sunday because my dad was not saved, and we worked every Sunday. When I got saved, I had a job that required me to work on Sunday at Winn-Dixie. I don't know if there are any Winn-Dixies anymore, but I used to work at a Winn-Dixie. And y'all, you knew when church was out? All those folks in their finest, their Sunday finest, would come in and they'd buy their week's groceries on Sunday afternoon. I never understood that. But that, I mean, I'm not talking about come in to get a jug of milk or something. You know, the big heaping mound of groceries. And while it may not be true anymore because there are so few Christians in the society, the blue laws in the past didn't have to exist because the people of God would not go purchase anything on Sunday, which, by the way, is not the Sabbath. You understand? Sabbath is not Sunday. Sunday is the Lord's Day. Sabbath begins on sundown on Friday, and it ends at sundown on Saturday. So we have this issue. But notice what it says in the text. Verse 31, and if the peoples of the land bring in goods or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on a holy day. So not just the Sabbath, but those festivals. And there were a lot of festivals. If you're going to plan a business calendar around the Jewish calendar, there are going to be a lot of days off. And if you're an employer, you're going to have, you know, you're going to look like a lot of time that you're not getting business done because of that. Just realized I got that thing still in my ear from driving. Y'all see me with that, please tell me to take it out because I try not to do that. So verse 31, they won't buy on any day nor will they sell. And then this seventh year, let's talk about that. If you got your Bible, turn to Leviticus chapter 25. This is called the Sabbath year. My granddaddy, I wish I had listened to him. He told me you should never borrow more money than you can pay back in 7 years. And that entire concept is based on this idea of the Sabbath year. Because it would all be forgiven. And so if you were going to loan to somebody, you wouldn't want to lose any money, so you would only loan them the amount they could pay back in 7 years. And our whole society has not been Christian for some time in our money principles, because 30-year mortgages, 15-year mortgages, I mean, we've been borrowing so much. And now, you know, you can get a 40-year mortgage. You can get a 40-year mortgage now. I remember the first car. Yeah, they're setting it up. Yeah, they'll sell you anything you want, buddy, if you'll sign the dotted line and agree to pay so much a month. You remember when you first bought a car? There were 2-year notes, 24 months, then 36 months, then 48. Now it's 72 or 84 months to buy a car. Well, the thing's going to be worn out. But young people don't know any better, and they're borrowing. And one of the best things I've ever done is I allowed my oldest son to buy a car, co-signed it with him, and he had to pay a 4-year note. And, buddy, he's so ready. He'll pay it off in October this year. He's so ready to be out of debt. He's never borrowed another dime, and that's one of the smartest things as a parent I ever did. I didn't want to let him do it, but I did, and I look back on it. I don't think he's figured it out. And I've been telling him and telling him and telling him until he had to make those payments. Nothing else communicated.
Their idea is, though, I'm going to be making payments, I'm just going to be paying on a new car.
Yeah, and that's, but see, the way they were raised, my children, they know that's not true, because their parents, I mean, I buy a car and I drive it till it disintegrates. And then I get another one. But I just... that's an expense, and getting that through to them is really difficult. My youngest son, he's driving a vehicle that is funny to watch him drive, because he changes colors routinely because he's working on it and he has to do different things to it. It's a junker, but it's perfect for him. And I think so many times parents, it's not about the parent. I mean, it's about the parent, not the child. They're not trying to teach the child something. They want folks to think that their family is of a certain standing that they can afford. You know, my kid turned 16. I got him a new car. You know, he's going to go to the finest schools, wear the finest clothes. And it's more about the parent than it is the child. And I just think that's sad. Look at Leviticus chapter 25. Now, what's the book of Leviticus about? It's the law, but that's not what I asked you. What's it about? What's the purpose of the law? You go over and over through Leviticus, you find this phrase running through it, and they will know that the Lord their God is holy. It's about being holy. And all those laws are supposed to be given so that we know that we are holy and that He is holy, and we're to be holy as He is. So the Sabbath year is in chapter 25. It starts in verse 1, but in verse 18 it says, "Therefore you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them, and then you will dwell in the land securely." So by keeping the Sabbath year, the promise, the blessing for obeying this is that you will be in the land securely. So if you were somebody in this crowd with Nehemiah that day, being in the land securely, that'd be a big thing to you, wouldn't it? You just heard them read this law. So you would have picked up on that and went, "Whoa, Eris, we need to do that. Whatever that is, we need to do that. We want to be in the land securely." Okay? So that's what they heard. "The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. And if you say, 'What shall we eat in the seventh year, if we not sow or gather in our crop?' I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the ninth year when its crop arrives. So, now, y'all all gardeners? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. But if you plant a, if you ever do this kind of thing, for us, there are some years you can't describe why. You just have a whole lot more. I don't know. Was it a couple of years ago? I kept bringing apples to church. My apple trees at my farm, which I do nothing to except just look at them, and they just had apples, and they kept having apples. There have been years that I've brought tomatoes to church because my tomatoes just produced much more than normal. But this idea of letting the land lay fallow, if you study agri-science, allowing the land to do nothing improves the land and it improves the crops. So while God is blessing them and they're doing it for obedience, there is background, scientific background that backs up this concept of allowing the land to lay fallow. So, you and I in America are so sick of the disease of thinking that we're the smartest people that have ever been on the planet and that we know more and we know better. And so, in our finances right now, the idea, you remember when we quit calculating interest the way you learned in school, and it went to this APR stuff and all these other things that is, you have to, huh? All the financial things that we have invented, that's what caused the last 08 bomb. And it may cause another one, I don't know. We thought we've gotten so smart that we can find shortcuts to things that are eternal values. And one of those is the law of the harvest. Okay, the law of the harvest is really important. Crops never come out before seed go in. I mean, don't care how smart you are, that don't happen. Also, the law of the harvest, you get more out of what than you put in. Okay, you plant a kernel of corn and you get a stalk that will produce 3 ears of corn. So there is a multiplication effect. But you can't go plant today and harvest tomorrow. And that's the part we as Americans have missed. And think about your students. If your child is studying, we call it cramming for an exam. You have your children, or you've ever crammed for an exam? Well, there's only so much your brain can absorb in one sitting. If you'll do a little a day, the cumulative effect is much greater than cramming for the exam. When I used to teach school, I would try to teach the students what I call the law of the harvest and explain to them, you know, if you're going to cram for my exam, I promise you right now you're going to fail because I'm going to design it so that you will. I don't want you to go to college and be a chemistry student with an A knowing nothing, because that which you learn by cramming, you forget as quickly as you learned it. So it goes in, it goes right back out. So we need to understand these ideas. And this is where I think as a society we're so sick, because we thought we've known better than God. We've done our own thing. And as a result, we are reaping right now and beginning to reap that which we've sown. If you sow the whirlwind, the Bible says you're going to reap the whirlwind. Now, look at verse 32. Starting now to move to money in Nehemiah. And I don't know, we seem sometimes, I think, to violate this so routinely. Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 32. Did you see that last part? We will forgo the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Now, how do you think that would go over if we tried to get a law passed in Congress that every debt would be forgiven every 7 years? Yeah. Wall Street would scream, right? But that's a... Yes, there would. Yes, there would. Yes, there would. And that's okay. But that's one of the things, you know, we violate that routinely. But that's something I remember my granddaddy taught me. And it really, as I read this, it jumped out. Because I never really knew where he got it. I didn't never see him read the Bible, you know. But that's where he got it. Verse 32, we also take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. So a shekel was about 2/5 of an ounce or 11 grams. So they're giving a measure of money to the house of God. And the purpose of that is for the showbread, the regular grain offering, the regular burnt offering, the Sabbaths, the new moons, the appointed feasts, the holy things, and the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel and for all the work of the house of our God. So this would be the equivalent of what you and I might call our general fund. This is going to pay the light bill. This isn't designated stuff. This is the things that keep the temple being the temple and the offerings that are needed to be offered in general. This isn't you having a sin offering for yourself or a thank offering or something. This is just the general offerings that were supposed to be happening all along. And that showbread's supposed to be there, you know, regularly. All these things are supposed to take place. Then, verse 34, we the priests, the Levites, and the people have likewise cast lots for the wood offering to bring in into the house of our God according to our fathers' houses at times appointed year by year to burn on the altar of the Lord our God as it is written in the law. We obligate ourselves to bring the first fruits of our grain and the first fruits of all fruit of every tree year by year to the house of the Lord. So the money, the grain, and the animals, the offerings of the temple, that's the first thing they're going to do there, verse 32 and 34. And now we move to the idea of first fruits. Okay, how many tribes are there in Israel? Wrong. Wrong. There are 13. The Levites. And the reason the reason I asked that at this point, the Levites were what? They were the first fruits. They were the first fruits. God said when they counted in numbers, every firstborn, everything that opens the womb is God's. And when they did the counting of all the tribes, Levi most closely numbered that number. And so God basically says, give me the Levites, they'll be my people. They'll be the tribe unto myself. And then Joseph got two tribes. Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's sons. So there's not a tribe of Joseph. So if you go back and you look, I've had people come ask me, I hear you say that the 12 tribes of Israel were the sons of Jacob? Didn't you say that? Yeah. Well, where is the tribe of Joseph? I just can't find it. Yeah, it's a good question. I always enjoy that. But think about that, the first fruits. So this is what they're saying, we're going to give the first fruits. So in Exodus chapter 13, let's look at that concept of first fruits, because do we do anything like this? Some people do, and please hear me, we shouldn't have to do any of this because Jesus fulfilled the law, okay? So all this is past, but there are some things that God's people just do because remember, we're not giving offerings because we have to, right? If you're giving offerings because you have to, you might as well quit giving your offerings. You give offerings because you get to. Because you want to. It's not because you have to. So Exodus chapter 13, the consecration of the firstborn is what that chapter is about. And it introduces the Feast of Unleavened Bread in verse 3. But then when you get down to verse 11, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as He swore to you and your fathers, and you shall give it to you, you shall set apart for the Lord all that first opens the womb, all the firstborn of your animals that are males shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of a man among your sons you shall redeem. And when it's in time to come, your sons ask you, what this means, shall say to them, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord has brought us out of Egypt. So this was an object lesson that would keep the idea that how God had delivered them out of the hand of Pharaoh on that Passover night when all the firstborn were slain. And by giving this each time, it is to remind them of that over and over and over. And you and I need that kind of reminding, don't we? And don't we remember what cost us? A great object lesson. But that's what this is about in Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 35 and 37, is this idea of this object lesson of the firstborn. What are some times that people that you or people you know give offerings outside? I'm not talking about tithing. I'm talking about just giving an offering. Usually in our churches, it's for building funds, right? People will give, if they're going to give something extra, it'll go to the building fund. Are there any other things that you guys can think of people give offerings to? Benevolence? Yeah, missions, right? But that whole idea of an offering, that's something I think that in our indebted society, we need to teach more. Because I think too many people, they've taken and misapplied the concept of the tithe to almost communicate that this is a debt you owe, this is a bill you pay. And if you're going at it with that attitude, you're missing the whole point. So I think sometimes we've missed that.
And God don't want that building to start with.
That's right. You're the building of God. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that's the whole point, I think. Sometimes it's easier for us to give to a building than to give our heart. And so many people, I think, try to substitute that giving of their money or giving of their time instead of giving their obedience. I see that constantly. All right, look, if we will, this idea of the tithe, now 10%, verse 37b. And to bring to the Levites the tithes from our ground, for it is the Levites who collect the tithes in all our towns where we labor. A tithe. Melchizedek is where it's introduced in Genesis, I think, 14, and that's where the first mention is. It says it literally means a tenth. He gave him the word tithe and the word tenth are the same word. So some translations say tithe, and some of the newer translations, if you'll read Genesis 14, where Melchizedek comes and gives, Abram gives the tithe to Melchizedek, it's a tenth. But we do get this confused because the tithe is a commandment in the Old Testament. Jesus never says, don't tithe. He commends it. But if you read the New Testament, Jesus never asked for 10%. He asked for it all. Everything we have is we are to give. And I think sometimes we mistake that. I'm not saying you shouldn't give 10%. You should. But you should give more than that, I think. And if you were to add up all the different offerings, if you go through and really do this, and it's been a while since I did this, Miss Ann, so I may be off a few percents. But if you were to add up each of the different offerings that the Hebrews were commanded by God to give, it is a little over 20% that they would be giving. Yeah. Well, in the Hebrew, the word, it literally, it's the same word. Yeah. Yeah. It's tenth. This is what it means.
Genesis
14, verse 20. Thank you. Well, I did pretty good. I got the chapter off the top of my head. Considering I couldn't find my belt this morning, I'm impressed. All right. Verse 38. And the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites receive the tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes to the house of our God. So 10% of the 10%. This is where some people get the idea in Baptist churches of giving 10% of the church budget to Lottie Moon or Annie Armstrong or Associational Missions or whatever. You may have heard people talk about that. Because here's the tithe of the tithe, and that's going to the house of God. I've never heard that.
What, that a pastor doesn't have to tithe?
No. Yeah.
From what I have.
I'm clearly going to the wrong churches.
I've heard quite a few pastors say, no, I don't have to tithe.
I'd be changing churches.
Yeah. Well, Lord, I just noticed
something. All right. I'm scared. Let me just say that. Oh, okay. Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's for them. See, what the Levites are receiving, and that's their salary. No, they're getting 90%. A tenth of the tithe. They're getting the tithes coming to them that people give them, and then they're taking a tenth of what they received to the storehouse. So they're living on 90%. Yeah, yeah. But that's where she's saying people have used that. You know, I would be afraid to stand and preach and say I didn't have to tithe. Now, that's not saying that there are times that I haven't tithe. Took me a while to figure all this out. But I'd be afraid to do that. I really would. Now, sometimes as pastor, you don't necessarily give all your tithe to the church you're pastoring. There have been times I've done that and supported other works and other things, particularly when I didn't think that the church I was serving needed it at that moment. And I knew someone who did. I got an email the other day from Ed Stetzer asking me to support a new church plant because of things I've done in the past. But, you know, just different things that you do. But everybody, anybody is supposed to be giving their tithe and more than their tithe as best they can to every aspect of God's work. Sometimes I do admit it is difficult when you're tithing as the pastor to a church because you're giving and you're getting. That is uncomfortable because you receive a, you know. So sometimes I think it's more blessed as a pastor to give to an organization that's not giving you a check back. Does that make sense?
Would you take
Yeah, yeah, and there's some of that you go, yeah, you go, ugh. Yeah, but you get used to it. You get used to it. All right, look at the 10% there, so we've got that. And the last part there, verse 39, for the people of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of grain, wine, and oil to the chambers where the vessels of the sanctuary are, as well as the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and the singers. We will not neglect the house of our God. So this idea of attending faithfully the house of God comes out of that last sentence. We will not neglect the house of our God. And that's something our people don't know today. I mean, you know, as pastor, you'll see one group maybe every third Sunday. You know, you've got your people who come all the time. But then mixed in with them, there's a group that comes every other week and a group that comes every third week and a group might show up once a month and, you know. And then you ever have one Sunday, all of a sudden everybody's cycle hits and they all come and you have a big, what happened? Well, everybody's here. Yeah. Have that cycle. And we need to help people see that. But that's something that we routinely, hunting, fishing, ball games, reunions. Y'all don't have a thing here called decorations, do you? You do? Where I come from, in northern eastern Alabama, from about the month of May into June, about 6 to 8 weeks there, if you wanted to, you could go to a decoration every Sunday at different cemeteries or churches. Some people do. And of course, when they're doing that, they can't be at their church because they got to go be at the decoration. And that was a big deal when I first started pastoring. You know, if we had a deacon candidate, somebody ask him, okay, are you gonna spend 3 months out every year decorating every grave you can see? No, okay. You know, we used to like to ask that question. So, where is this? In Cherokee County, okay. It must have something to do with the Civil War. Yeah, right. But a lot of the older, you know, out in the rural areas, the churches and the cemeteries were combined. Yeah, yeah. The reason I say that, the first church I actually pastored was Moshat, Moshat Baptist Church in Center Alabama. And its claim to fame was that the man who fired the first shot at Fort Sumter that began the Civil War was buried there. And every year, the first Sunday of May, the Daughters of the Confederacy, and yes, I don't know if you know, but there is such an institution, they would come and have a ceremony in that cemetery across the street from the church every year. And the first Sunday of May, this little church that had 18 members when I became its pastor, we'd have 150 people in there on the first Sunday of May because it was Decoration Sunday. They all came to decorate. They came and they ate, and it was a big doings. So once a year, I had a house full to preach to. I loved it.
You know who shot back?
No.
Abner Doubleday. He got it discovered baseball.
Really? Didn't know that.
He was a lieutenant in the Union Army. It looked something wrong. I'll tell you this on that guy.
Yeah. I wish I knew this gentleman's name. I know where the grave is. I could go find it out. But Abner Doubleday. Well, I won't allow my Southern heritage to call me to no longer like baseball because of that. All right. Look at these are the characteristics that I pulled out of this text that I think we should apply to our churches for Christian living out of chapter 10, the commitments they made after they heard God's law read and after they repented and confessed. First, I think we really need to do everything we can to get our young women and our young men to marry within the Christian faith, to not become unequally yoked. There was somewhere long ago when I was a youth pastor, there was a little pamphlet I used to give the kids, and in it said, never go on a date with someone who wouldn't make a godly mate. That's a good rule of thumb if we could get them to follow. The second there is to give God His day of rest. You know, this is something we routinely violate as Americans. We don't rest at all. And if we do rest, we take the whole day and we rest and we don't give God His day. The third thing there is to remind ourselves of the sacrifice Jesus made for our sin. All those sacrifices that they're doing are pointing to Jesus. And they're doing them almost routinely. There's something happening every day. And that's pointing to us. We need to be making those routine sacrifices in our own heart. Now, we're not going to kill anything. We're not going to be shedding blood. But we need to be consciously every day reminding ourselves of the sacrifice that Jesus has made to forgive us of our sins. We need to remember that we are responsible to the Lord and should follow His guidelines, obey His laws or His rules, and honor Him. And those three and four happen in reading the Bible and prayer. And then number five, support the church out of gratitude. Don't rob God, and that's a direct quote out of Malachi chapter 3, verse 10. To withhold the tithe is to rob from God. And then to not neglect meeting with others for mutual support, worship, or prayer. We call that church. Now, you don't have to go to church to a building. I mean, there are such things as house churches. But you're getting those are the needs you should be getting, that mutual support, worship, and prayer. So that's kind of what I got out of this study.
Thanksgiving goes into that day of rest.
Yeah. Yeah, what does he say?
Well, he says it's for physical. Of course, it's for spiritual.
Right.
God knows that the body needs to stop.
Right.
One day of the week and regenerate.
Yeah.
And he said, and he talks about people that wind up with physical problems.